Hi, I'm Norman Gray.
And this, in case anyone's having a little panic, is the relativity and gravitation strand of astronomy 2. Good, you all know who you are. Now, there's a couple of... This first lecture is always a little bit weird because there's a bit of preparatory stuff we've got to get through about how I organise the course and the topics I'm going to sort of gallop through in this first lecture seem a bit disconnected. And that's because they are sort of disconnected, but they are important ideas that you've got to get under your skin, really, more or less, over the rest of the course. So you will come back to this material again and again over the course of these 15 lectures. But we'll only really get properly going in the next lecture tomorrow. So with that said... That's the wrong computer. With that said, there are some things I want to make sure to say, which are if you look in the Moodle at the relevant page, you'll see that there. I will show you a picture of the Moodle. Just so we know what we're talking about. You will see that there are a number of resources under section 10. Let's go to section 10, including the lecture notes. And the lecture notes include introduction.pdf, axioms.pdf, and there are some other versions of those, which are the same, but in a slightly laid out slightly differently in a way which might, I aim to be more useful on a tablet. Whichever one, it's the same in both of them, whichever one works better for you, and that's a theme. Because these notes are fairly comprehensive. There's a lot of text in there. And the way that I have ended up delivering these lectures is that the main event is the lecture, right? That's the thing we focus on. But the notes are the sort of co-main event, if you like. They are co-equal with the lecture as the way I'm delivering this stuff to you. Because relativity makes a lot more sense the second time you do it. And if I do it in a lecture and I do it in the notes, you're sort of getting two goes at it at once. And that's important because it will only make sense the second time you do it. Now, if you think notes first, I'm going to read the notes and then just check what he says in the lecture, that's good. If you think I'm going to sit back and sort of let it wash over me in the lecture and then check what's happening in the notes, that's good too. But you have to decide how you organise it. Okay? You have to sort of take charge of your own learning here and work out how do I, work out what's going on here. And it was someone like Sam Goldman of the movie Mogul who said, half of the money I spend on advertising is wasted, but I don't know which half. And half of what I say in the notes is irrelevant to you because you don't need that bit. But the half that is needed for you is different for all of you. So there is quite a lot of material here. There's a lot of pages here. Don't panic. You're not supposed to memorise everything, okay? The notes are there as a resource for you to go revisit what happened in the lecture and make sense of it the second time. It follows that it's a good idea to look at the notes before the lecture. Now, you don't have to understand everything, but you get an idea of what's coming out. This isn't a detective mystery. There are no cliffhangers. Spoilers are good. If you know what's coming up, then you can know, that bit didn't make sense in the notes. I'll really pay attention in the lecture, because it'll be explained in a slightly different way. Okay, I could go on at this for some length. I will post, right now these slides are in there because, for reasons, but I'll generally post the slides after the lectures. The slides, unlike, some people do have different opinions about how to lecture with slides. I don't like slides very much. So the slides I do are pretty minimal. They're really something for me to stand in front of, or a diagram to point to. There's nothing in the slides that isn't in the notes, okay? So don't think, oh my God, I've got to work through the slides as well. Okay? So the slide to there is a prop, which I put, I mean, I don't think there are, I don't think there's much point in putting them up here, really. But people want them. They feel secure if they've got a copy of the slides. So I do. Okay? But I don't rate the slides as a very important part of the learning resource. Okay? They're a prop for me. The Echo 360, I think that means this is being recorded. I don't know where it goes after this. Echo 360 is a bit of a novelty. I'm not very sure what happens. I trust it works. For the first couple of lectures, I will do record them myself, just as a bit of a backup to we reassure ourselves that does work. Don't rely on that, because some people think, oh, all the lectures are recorded, just go and listen to them afterwards. Doesn't really make a lot of sense, because being in the lecture, concentrating, is a part of the whole learning. The other big teaching resource is the exercises. Each of the chapters in the notes has a block of exercises, which are pretty clearly linked to specific parts of the notes. And relativity is something you only understand when you do the exercises. You cannot just sit back and think, yeah, I got that. You think you understood it when you sit in the lecture, but you didn't. Okay? Very probably not. Okay? It's when you're forced to rethink it and forced to bang your head on the table a bit going through the exercises, that's when you understand it. You go, oh, it's simple really. Okay? And that is also why it's in next semester that I'll release the solutions, the notes to the exercises, not this semester. Because, it's quite handy to check you've got the answer right, but it is more useful, countervailing that, to bang your head on the table a bit. It's the impacts that get the learning in. Okay? Okay. Other, where are we? Although it's terrifically old-fashioned, like the idea of aims and objectives, I think intended learning outcomes are one fashion later, and they are out of fashion. For me, the aims and objectives are very simple and a very useful structuring notion. Definitions differ, but for me, the aims are the point. They're why you're learning this, and why I'm teaching it. And there are things like understand, appreciate. The other things you'll remember after you've done the exam. In 2 years, you'll remember the aims, because that is why you're doing this course. And so if the exam were, do you understand things? You went, yeah. Then we'd all be a lot happier. That'd be a nice exam. But it doesn't really work in assessment terms. So, as well as the aims, there are the objectives. And the objectives are party tricks. The things you can do, things that you can be assessed on. They're not terribly exciting necessarily, but the best way of achieving the objectives is to achieve the aims. So if you understand something, then the objectives become pretty easy. Okay? But they are the nice concrete things which you can do. There are things like provide descriptions of such and such. Describe, as if in an exam answer, blah, 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 and so on. So that's a very clear distinction. I tend to associate exercises with objectives. When I'm making up the exam, I look at the list of objectives. So that's, it's not a one-to-one mapping, but there is a correlation between what I think is, what's in the objectives and what I think is fair game in the exam. And things which are clearly not in the objectives are clear at the exam. Ask me questions, but that's the basic answer I'll give you whenever you ask me that question. Okay, time is moving on very rapidly. And my timetable for this lecture, because this lecture is timetabled in a way that other ones aren't so much, it's already all short. So, we'll just press on. This remark is here because it's just backing up the remark I made that a lot of this is for you to work out what you need to read. So there's more material than you might like, but that's because I'm sort of forcing you to think. You will probably have look at all the words and all the notes, but you'll study only selected bits. And there are various signposts. The aims and objectives are signposts. At the end of each section, I tend to have a couple of key points, which are also signposts as what you should have picked up from that. These are very standard things. So, that's all. The other odd thing I've got to remember, I was asked to say to you, is there is no lab this afternoon. I think you know that, because I think you were told that on Moodle, but to save you trekking up to GarthCube, just remember, no lab this afternoon. Okay? They start, I'm not sure when they start. I don't have to know that, so I don't. Any questions about the other sort of organisational things? Have I forgotten anything obvious? Nope. Okay. So, onward to the physics bit. I have on the next slide put all of the physics you will learn in the next 10 weeks, because we do 10 weeks on special relativity and 5 weeks on general relativity. So all the physics you'll learn in the next 10 weeks. That's it. It's two sentences. There's all inertial reference frames are equivalent to the performance of all physical experiments. It's called the equivalence principle. And the speed of light is the same constant value when measured in any inertial frame. That's it. Why am I spending 10 weeks talking about that? Because those are easy to state, and those are the physical statements you didn't know before. But the consequences of these are intricate. And even understanding what those words mean is a bit subtle. And so there's not a lot of volume to learn in this course. You don't memorize stuff. I have a rotten memory, so I don't think it's fair to think you to raise you to memorize stuff when I can't. So demonstrating that you understand these things is the point of the objectives. So there's not a lot to learn. And this is both is and isn't a mathematical course. The maths we use in this course is addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, square roots. Later on, we use differentiation. But it's all school physics. It's all school maths. There is no funky maths in this course. But in a different sense, this is a mathematical course. Because the way we start things, there's no seat of the pants intuitive, you'll get this picture and you'll understand it. There's no seat of the pants intuitiveness in this course. It's all about this axiomatic approach. This is the fundamental insight, which is expressed in logical form of a fairly mathematical style of thinking. And then you proceed carefully and thoughtfully forward in a mathematical style. So although the arithmetic you use is very simple, the style is quite abstract. And that is, and that's, I think, the first course you've done where that's true. Your first year courses have tended to be more physics-y. Unless apart from any pure maths courses that you've done, so that will be a bit of a jolt, okay. Also, you have done a bit of special relativity before, I think, in Physics 1. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. And that's, I think, sort of two lectures or something. And I'm sure the word Lorentz transformation was mentioned in events and stuff, but that's just two lectures. How can I spin it out to 10 lectures? Because I want you to actually understand it. And you can't do that without sort of going round and round several times and getting a bit confused. So this is quite a thorough version of special relativity. But these are the only physical statements, the only statements about the world, the only things about the world that could be otherwise that I'm going to make. Until a bit later. All the rest is deduction. So, as I said, this first lecture is dotting around a bit. What happens next is chapter 2, which I think is what we'll get through in one lecture, is going through those axioms and saying, what do they actually mean? What do those words mean? Chapter 3 and 4, which I think is three lectures, basically, roughly, is about the fairly direct consequences of those actions. Okay, given those axioms, what follows? And there's quite a lot of follows pretty directly before you get into anything calculational. And that's interesting. Those axioms, although they look very simple, are full of physical content. Chapter 5 is where we got onto the main apparatus, the main technological tool of relativity. Given a frame that's moving past you, how do you say this event that happened here happened in those coordinates in the moving frame, blah, blah, blah. Those words will mean more in a short while. After that, that's sort of the first pillar of the whole thing. After that, we talk about, I think we'll spend 3 lectures on that. Okay. The kinematic dynamics is how do you describe motion? How do you talk about momentum and energy and conservation of things in a relativistic context? You're familiar with these things from Physics 1. What do these ideas look like in a relativistic context? And that's the sort of thing that's very important if you're doing particle physics, for example. And then chapters 8 and 9, the last 5 lectures, is general relativity. We cannot go into the maths of general relativity because that is actually quite hard. I mean, that's an honours master's course. But what we can do is give an account of general relativity which has much more textured, is much more substantial, because we'll spend 10 lectures, thinking through the terminology and thought processes of special relativity. So there's a lot more substance we can say about general relativity. So it's beyond a popular account, but we can't get to a fully technical account. So we can get to that intermediate range there. And that's 5 lectures. Okay. So I'm not going to I'm going to gallop through these now, really, but that's okay because I want to have said these things to you at one point. Even though it doesn't sort of matter that I'm going to go through them too quickly, because we're going to be coming back to them again and again and again in later weeks. So I'm sort of logging these in your head. Just now, but you'll come back to these. You'll come back to the notes for these bits again and again, and we will talk over them again and again. Okay. Key thing number 1: what is an event? An event is that. That happened there. It happened 2 meters from that door, from that wall, 1.5 meters up on the floor. 4 meters from there, and it happened 10 seconds ago. So there's 4 numbers attached to it. 3 spatial coordinates and a time coordinate. But notice that I said it happened from that wall, that wall, that wall. Someone in the street would give different physical coordinates to that event. Okay, obviously. So the event is in some sense absolute. There's no question that event happened, but the numbers you use to describe it are relative. So the first word, we're going to use that word a lot. That's the first time it comes in. They are basis dependent. They are coordinate frame dependent. So my coordinate system in this room starts with an origin over there. Say, blah blah blah. You can imagine the 3 axes. Someone standing in the street has a different coordinate system. My watch. I said it happened 10 seconds ago from when it was. Someone might say, oh, it happened at 11 and a half hours from midnight. So the 0 of position and the 0 of time is up to you. It's up to the definition of the coordinate frame. Another sort of event is I caught it. I didn't miss it. I caught it. So how did I catch it? I caught it because my hand and the eraser were in the same place at the same time. And it doesn't matter what coordinates you give to that. Coordinates relative to this room, coordinates relative to the Tobias Road. They were in the same place at the same time. And there's nothing relative about that. There's no point of view in which I didn't catch it. If 2 cars collide, then metal is bent. And there's no point of view in which that metal isn't bent. There's no way you can be moving in which you look at it in a funny way and they missed each other. So two things which happen, which collide, which are at the same place at the same time, are there absolutely. Why is he saying this again and again? Why is he making a fuss of this? It's obvious. Yes, it's obvious. But it remains obvious, if you like, even when there's lots of other things that you thought were obvious aren't obvious anymore. So it does need saying that remains true. So which of the following are events? Who would say a supernova explosion was an event? Put your hand up. Who would say it wasn't? Who would say a concert was an event? Who would say it wasn't? Who would say the whole country clapping its hands at once was an event? Not? Okay. A collision between two particles in the LHC, is that an event? Not? I agree with most of you, even when you disagree with each other. Because a concert, okay, that is a sort of an event in the sense that it happens at a place and a time. It said that on a ticket. You'll be here at this time and the thing will start. But it also has a duration. And so in that sense, it's not an event. Because it's a sequence of events, it's a sequence of notes, if you like, which are all in the individual events. So an event has no duration. So the start of the concert is unequivocally an event, but the concert as a thing, because it has duration. And similarly, the whole kind of clapping hands at once. Well, yes, that does, that sort of has a sort of definite time, but it's also spread out in space. Because it's the whole country doing it at once there. It's not happening at a place. You can't say, what is the place at which the whole country does this? Okay, if you stand sufficiently far back, okay, it happened in the UK. But if you're in the UK, then because it was spread out in space, it didn't happen at a place. And that means, and we'll get on to this next time, I think, that means it didn't happen at a time. It seems obvious that if everyone claps, that when I say everyone claps their hands at once, that seems obviously, well, I know what that means. Turns out you don't. If something is extended in space, the question of what time did it happen at becomes much more complicated. And we'll come to that, I hope, in a moment. Certainly we'll come to that again and again and again over the next few weeks. So, and there's no issue about the point four. If those things were in the same place at the same time, then they collided, that happened at a place and a time. End of story. So, yeah. What I said. So, next, how do we locate these events? I've alluded to this, but what we do is we have reference frames and we have observers. And these two phrases mean something very specific. A reference frame, they're not exotic, but we do have a very specific meaning when we talk about these in this context. A reference frame is a coordinate system. It's an origin and a set of axes in space and in time. So it's saying that is the zero of my coordinate system and I'm measuring all times from midnight. I've defined a coordinate system fairly straightforwardly. Someone else can have a different coordinate system, as I've said. So there's nothing. So a coordinate system is a. There are infinite many coordinate systems. Okay, everyone gets a coordinate system. Everyone gets lots of coordinate systems. Okay, the coordinate system that makes most sense to you is the one in which you're standing still in it. Okay, but there's nothing special about that. And that is the thing about relativity. There's nothing special about the coordinate system that you choose within certain limits, because there are different observers. And observers are, well, observers. Again, not an exotic notion, but when we talk about an observer in special relativity, we mean someone with a notebook who is very short-sighted. Notebook and a watch, and very short-sighted. And they will pay attention to things that happen in front of their nose. And they will write down where they are when that happens. So, okay. It happened at 11:40. and I'm at this position in the coordinate. They'll write that down and make a note. And that's their job. If it happened over there, they're not interested. Okay. So observers are in a coordinate system. They know where they are in the coordinate system, in space and in time. They're all grid on the ground, and they know what spot they're standing on, and they've all got a watch. They know where they are and what time it is, and they only pay attention to things in front of their noses. Okay, they ignore things which happen elsewhere. If you want to work out where an event happened, you've got to have lots of friends. Okay, so if there was a firecracker went off in the middle of the room, the only person I'd be interested in who I would ask where did that happen and when is the unfortunate person who was sort of sitting on top of it when it went off. Everyone else ignored it, but that person, I ask, where are you? What time did it go off? No one else even saw it. Okay, hold on to that thought. So observers are very limited people, and what this is illustrating, we'll come back to, is two reference frames. A reference frame S, which has an X and a Y, and someone standing stationary in that reference frame with a watch, and someone in a different reference frame, S prime, which has a different X prime axis, a different Y prime axis, and they have a different watch. And they will ascribe. So if something happens, an event happens, and this second reference frame, S prime, is moving with respect to the first one at a speed V, so at all times, the location of the origin of this reference frame is at X in the S frame, S equals VT, simply because it's moving at a constant speed V. So there's a bit of school maths for you. Multiplication, distance is speed times time. Okay, you remember that bit. So what that is showing is a rather elaborate way of showing a moving reference frame. S prime is moving in the frame S at a speed V, so the origin is at space at a coordinate X. At the origin, that point there, is at coordinate X prime equals 0, and coordinate X equals VT. A point there is at coordinate x prime equals whatever, and at coordinate x equals whatever plus vt. Okay, so nothing exotic there. Okay, we'll get onto exotic later, but there's nothing exotic there. Okay, but those two observers only pay attention to things locally. Now, I've said it's possible to have lots and lots of different inertial frames, different reference frames. Everyone gets a reference frame. Everyone gets a coordinate frame. But some of them are special. Some of them, you can take it that you are not moving. Now, I'm standing here. I'm not having any difficulty standing here. I'm not being thrown about because the building isn't shaking. This is a good thing. If I were in a train, and the train is just bowling along the track in a nice, calm fashion, then I could stand on the train without difficulty. I could juggle or I could drink a cup of tea or whatever without difficulty, because as far as I'm concerned, I can regard that steadily moving train as being stationary. And it is stationary. There's no experiment I can do that would tell me that steadily moving train isn't stationary. I can look out of a window and see the landscape go by, but all that tells me is I'm moving with respect to the landscape. It doesn't mean I'm absolutely moving. I'm absolutely moving. Okay, it might shuggle, but it might be that there is some vibration in this, but that's just okay. It's vibrating, or whatever. And that's not that it's tricky to tell you're moving. It's not that no one knows how to tell you're moving. One of those axioms was you cannot tell you're moving at a constant speed, and a matter of deep physical principle. There is no physical experiment you could do that would tell you, if you're moving at a constant speed, that you are actually the one moving, as opposed to the rest of the world moving past you. And you've seen this, it's a hackneyed image. You're sitting in a train in a station, you're gazing blankly into space, and the train next to you is moving. And you don't know if your train has started off smoothly, whether it's that train that moved at the station or your train. You can't tell. And there's nothing. With sufficient precise experiments, you could, because if you had a little pendulum and you, as your train accelerated, you could, that little pendulum would pull to one side in a way you can imagine, or a ball on the table would roll off. So you can tell you're accelerating, absolutely, and there's no doubt that you're accelerating. If you're sitting in a train and it's accelerating at a station, you can feel you're being pushed the smaller your back. You can tell you're accelerating unequivocally and absolutely. But once you're not accelerating, your frame is as good as anyone. Your idea of stillness is as good as anyone else's. And that's, to repeat myself, that's not a curiosity, that's a fundamental physical principle that there are a lot of things about. And it's not, and it's called the principle of relativity. It's not Einstein's principle of relativity, it's Galileo's principle of relativity. Because he spelled it out quite like that, but it was Galilean physics rests on that as a notion. And so that means that those frames which are not accelerating have a special status. They are the ones that we're going to make all our measurements in. They are the ones we give a special name to, namely inertial reference frames, because they are inertial. Inertial in the sense that Newton's laws work in an inertial frame. If you say you're floating out in space, and we'll come back to this later on. If you, leave something where you just let go of something, it'll stay where it is. If you give something a push, it'll move in a constant speed until it hits something. Just like Newton's law say it should. If you are moving along on a smoothly moving train and you roll a ball across the table, it'll move in a straight line at a constant speed until it hits something. Newton's laws work. While the train is accelerating, if you try and roll the ball across the table, it'll go like that. There's a mysterious extra force which appears, which breaks Newton's laws. It doesn't break Newton's laws, it's called inertia. And if you're on a roundabout, on a children's roundabout, you throw a ball to someone across the other side of the roundabout, then it goes off to the one side. Is there a mysterious force that deflects it? No, it's just that you're in a rotating reference frame. Centripetal force, centrifugal force, is not a force. It's an illusion caused by being in a non-inertial frame. So the point of an inertial frame is that Newton's laws work in it, so you understand the physics of inertial frames. Physics of non-inertial frames is harder. Physics of inertial frames is easy, and we will always stick to inertial frames in special relativity. We will do the same thing when we get to general relativity, but we have to change our definition of what an inertial frame is, and that's exciting. But that's 10 lectures away. I don't feel I have time to go through this as a quick question. We'll have more of these quick questions in other lectures. Have a think about these when you're mulling over which of these count as inertial frames. We can talk about that at some point. Blah blah blah. So, how do we measure times? It's really easy how to measure. We know how to measure distances. We just draw things on the ground with a grid of things on the ground and work out where we are in the reference frame. How do we talk about time? Or look at a watch, how hard can it be? It turns out we have to be a little more specific than that, a little more precise than that. And this remark, in Einstein's remark, it comes from, I think, the 1905 paper. So the paper which introduced, bang, special relativity in its more or less its final form to the world. All our judgments in which time plays a part are judgments of simultaneous events. And that word simultaneous is a key one. If I say the train arrives at 7 o'clock, what I mean is the pointing of the small hand on my watch at 7 and the arrival of the train are simultaneous. Simultaneous in the sense they happen at the same place at the same time. So my watch doesn't have to be right, but when I say it happened at 7 on my watch. What I mean is the train was here in front of my nose, and so was my watch. And they were both doing that thing in front of my nose and therefore they are simultaneous in absolute sense. The word simultaneity gets more complicated if you're talking about things which are separate from each other, as we will discover. But in the same way, if you have two cars crashing because they and metal bending because they're in the same place at the same time, that's absolutely simultaneous. This is absolutely simultaneous. You can hold on to this notion. And the reason why I'm banging on about it, the reason why Einstein was banging on about it, is because that turns out to be a clarifying way of thinking about time. The time of an event is what happened on a clock which was at the same place at the same time. Okay, and again, you think this sounds like it's over, like excess precision. Why does this matter? This is the list of things I'm ticking off in this first lecture, which we'll come back with the significance of which we'll come back to next time. So we're going to see a lot of pictures of this. These are our two observers. We always have multiple observers because what we're interested in, the whole point of things like the Lorentz transformation are, someone in that frame, in that coordinate system, says this happened at this place and this time. I'm in this coordinate system with respect to which that coordinate system is moving. What is the position and time of that event in my reference frame? And that sounds, I think, why would one care? But that's the sort of boiled down question you have to answer in order to do things like talking about relativity Doppler shift, about things like general relativity. That it all boils down to that sort of question, even though it ended up being quite an abstract question. And that, in a way, is why I said this was quite a mathematical course. Because the idea that you take a complicated thing and boil it down to the simplest thing it could possibly be that still has the property, and you analyse the hell out of that, that's a quite mathematical approach to this. You can understand the rest by building up from that, but you tear down in order to build up. Okay? I can see some folk going, oh, this is sort of going to be great. Some folk going, oh, this is going to be terrible. But it's going to be great. It's a tremendous intellectual experience. The point is that there are multiple observers, okay? And each of them knows where they are because they've got one of these little surveyors things which let them work out where reference to the origin of their frame they are. So they can put a mark in the ground and attach a position coordinate to that. And they've all got a watch, which they can look at with their short sight. Okay, we'll see these people again and again. So, imagine you're standing on a bridge over a motorway, looking at a police officer standing beside the road. So you're looking down, and they're standing beside the road. Like that. And a car driver goes past them and sneezes. Whose watch do you consult to find out the time of this sneeze in your frame? And this is all happening at relativistic speed, so let's hold on to our intuition. Who says it's your watch? Who says it's the police officer's watch? Who says it's the driver's watch? Who hasn't put the hand up yet? Okay, I'll try again. Everyone had to put the hand up. I don't care what your answer is, but I want to see everyone's hand up at least once. Just, I don't know, have a punt, make a guess. Who says it's your own watch? Who says it's the police officer's watch? Who says it's the driver's watch? Talk to your neighbour. Tell them why you're right. Normally, I would aim to give you more time to talk it over than that. But, folks, yeah. Normally I'd aim to give you a bit more time to talk it over than that. But we're galloping through to the end here. So, after discussion, who would say your own watch? Who would say the police officer's watch? Who would say the driver's watch? It's the police officer's watch. Why? Because the police officer is in your frame. you and the police officer are both in the same frame. You're both standing stationary in the motorway frame. Neither of you is moving. That's the point. The driver is moving. Okay? So they're not in your frame. They're not an observer you want to talk to. You only want to talk to observers who are stationary in your frame. Why not your watch? Because you're short-sighted too. You can't even see this driver. And so the driver's sneeze didn't happen in front of you. Well, the police officer, they were standing there when the sneeze happened. And the driver went going past, sneezed, and the police officer looked at their watch. So they're the only person who can say what the time of that event was in the motorway frame. Now, the driver of the car, they know what time it happened in their frame. They can look at their watch. And it turns out they'll give a different answer from the police officer. But we don't care, to begin with, in measurement terms, what it said in their watch. We care what happened in our frame, and the only people we can talk to are the observers in their frame, and the only one observer whose opinion matters is the observer who was next to the event when it happened. Now, the event didn't happen in the motorway frame rather than the car frame. The event didn't happen in the car frame rather than the motorway frame. It happened in all the frames. So this is a good point at which I can say, don't get into the way of thinking an event happens in a frame. An event happens. It's a thing in the world. It happens in all frames. But different people ascribe different coordinates to it. Meditate on that. And we have run out of time. So I will have to just gallop through the last couple of bits of this first chapter next time, which is tomorrow. And I think we are in the Adam Smith building, which is the lecture series that we will swap back and forth between next time. So I'll see you tomorrow.